Welcome to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast, where we focus on the people, the products, and the process of e-commerce selling today. Here's your host, Stephen Peterson.
Welcome back to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. This is episode 66, Jason T. Smith. Yes, this is about Jason T. Smith from Thrift Hunters, who is a television star, two seasons. And, you know, this is a tough interview for me because everybody knows him. You know, his story's out there. He's been so visible, so vocal. But what I like is he's so real. He's such a real guy. And I think this segment really shows you that. And I think he's such a great guy. Just can't wait to see him again coming up soon. So let's get into the podcast. All right, welcome back to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. And man, tonight's guest is a movie star, superstar, at least in my mind. You know, it's one of the, I remember meeting him, I guess it was a year or two ago, and I'm standing next to him like, oh my God, I'm so tiny next to this man. Jason T. Smith. Welcome, Jason. Welcome.
How are you?
I'm really well. Do you remember when we met? I think it was in Baltimore or down that way. And Andy Slamet and I had brought chocolate.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that giant chocolate bar?
Oh, yeah.
That was a great event. And I do want to talk about your speaking because that was what you were doing at that event. And it was just incredible. Again, you know, such common sense. So I want to get there. But first, I want to go back. Let's go back to the beginning, Jason.
Back it up.
You were 3 years old. What were you doing? Take me all the way back. When did you start thinking about becoming a seller?
At three, I was just starting to develop what I should have developed when I was one. And you didn't know you were going to get this, but I was born without hips. And
Wait.
Yes.
Born without hips.
Yes. So when I should have been nobody knew, because when you're a baby and you're fresh and you're gooey, nobody ever know that, especially back in the early 70s. When I should have started crawling, though, I wasn't. I couldn't. And so they could not figure it out. And I was the first baby, the first kid for my parents, the first grandkid for both sides. And so they were freaking out a little bit. Took me to the doctor, ran some x-rays, and they found out that I didn't have hips when I was born, but they were growing now. And the problem, when you're a gooey little baby, they weren't growing together because there was nothing to hold them into place. So from about 6 months to maybe a year and a half or a year and 2 months, I was in a cast from my waist down to let my hips grow and grow together.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I was the easiest baby ever to babysit because you just leaned me in the corner of a couch. I couldn't go nowhere.
You were truly a blob. You were dead. That's it. Just put the blob in a corner.
And
you were probably a big baby, I would assume,
too. No, I was very normal size. My sister and I weighed the same when we were born. I was like 7 pounds, 7 3/4 pounds.
How tall are you?
I am 6'5 and 280 right now.
Yeah, so we're talking big man. So you were normal size back then. That's really interesting.
Yeah, so at three, I was doing stuff you should have been doing at one, but then I caught up, and then my height skyrocketed quickly. When I was in kindergarten, I was as tall as my kindergarten teacher. Now, she was very short, but I don't care how short your teacher is, no kindergartner should be as tall as their teacher.
That's crazy.
And when I played Little League ball, so I was like 10 years old, I had to wear the coach's college pants because Little League pants were too tiny for me.
Did you play any other sports?
I played football for a season. I think I did high school right. And I know this is not what we're supposed to be talking about, but
It's okay.
If you're young and you hear this, listen to this. You know, if you go through high school doing one thing, that's cool. But here's how I did it. My freshman year, I was a band geek. I was in the marching band. So I saw every Friday night from the perspective of the marching band. And then I started working out. And I went from kind of doughy to kind of chisel. And I'm like, I'm going to play football. I'd never played in my life. So sophomore year, I played football, and I was only playing JV, and I didn't know a ton, but I was quite good. I could, for a big guy, I had a lot of speed. I could run down the quarterback. And the summer between sophomore and junior, I injured my back 3 times. So there went the end of my football career. So junior year, my friends and I just snuck beer into the football game, so then we were just degenerates the junior year. And then the senior year, I was the assistant editor for the yearbook, so I got to see all the games and the whole school without even having to have a pass. I could wander about at my leisure. So I saw high school 4 years, 4 different ways.
Hmm.
Love it. I mean, a big guy like you, yeah, I'm surprised. They were probably dying to get you back on the field.
When you're playing JV and you're my size, because I should have, you know, had I played football all my life, I already would have been on varsity by sophomore because of my size and my speed, and I really built up great strength. But I didn't know the game. I knew football, but I never played. So I didn't know the nuances of actually playing. So, of course, I had played JV, and most JV quarterbacks were about half my size. So I came at them. I saw the fear in their eyes, and I loved every bit of that.
Did you really?
Because I didn't play much, but when I played, I chased down a few quarterbacks, and I brought them down. And I was always on punts, too. So when the other team was punting, my job was to level the tight end across from me. And those kids would be about 5'2", and I'm already like 6'2", and I would just lay them out. I'm like, I like football. This is fun.
This is fun. So you did go to college. And what was interesting for you in college?
Well, I applied to one college for one reason, and that's why I went. And I majored in pop culture. So my major, my days were spent reading Batman comics, watching movies, and writing papers on the birth of rap music.
And because that was what interested you?
Oh, yeah. That's the only thing that interested me. The problem was, I went to those classes and passed them with A's. I forgot to go to the rest of the boring classes like English and science and math and stuff.
They're kind of important. Those are, you know, in the educational world,
yes.
They kind of think that that's important. They kind of see some importance there. So do you think, though, as a kid growing up, right, I've been following a trend that one thing leads to another. Somebody said that to me in one of the interviews, and it just keeps – showing its face with successful e-commerce people. I see a real trend that something that you did in your youth, as a young adult, whatever, you might not use for a long time. But then when you become an e-commerce seller, and especially as it's changed today versus what it was even, you know, 5 years ago, it really comes to fruition, that whatever you had and you learned. So in your world, were your parents entrepreneurs?
Actually, they were. When I was growing up, my grandparents owned a pizza shop. My mom and dad owned one. My aunts and uncles owned one. All the pizza shops came to an end at some point. My mom and dad opened a clothing store. When I was real little, my grandfather had an egg business selling eggs. They had 10,000 head of chicken. And so they would get the eggs, and my mom would check them to make sure they were good against the candlelight, and then my uncle would deliver them. And so, yeah, so my mom was brought up in an entrepreneurial kind of way. And they continued that. And not that they pushed it upon us or made us do it, but I had my first paper route probably when I was 9, and I started working at my grandparents' pizza restaurant when I was 10. So I was gainfully employed from 10 on. And
oh, yeah, I was going to ask you, what kind of jobs did you have in high school?
Well, mainly the pizza shop. I mean, I worked for my grandparents,
okay.
And I was good. I started at 10 just cleaning pans and cleaning dishes, and then I started making the dough. We made fresh dough, best crust you ever had in your life. And by the time I was 13 or 14, I had a crew underneath me. So I was the head doughboy, and I would have other doughboys, and some would be adults, you know, and I would make the schedule and everything. So I learned from an early age how to manage things and people, and I was running the whole business by the time I was 16. Unfortunately, both my grandparents passed away. They had four kids, my mom being one of them. They all inherited the business. My one aunt bought out her other three siblings. And her husband then assumed, because he owned a pizza shop, he knew how to run one. He had never run a business in his life, a restaurant business, and he wouldn't listen to a 16-year-old who had been there for six solid years.
What part of the country was this in?
Cleveland. Well, outside of Cleveland in the country.
So would that be Chicago-style crust?
No, it wouldn't. It'd probably be between New York and Chicago. So
okay.
Not super right. Deep, but it was
– not super thin either.
Correct, and it was
yeah.
Awesome. Yearn for it every day.
It's the water that makes that stuff.
I'll it could
you.
Be.
You know, when you go to New York, there's something about it, you know, and that seems to be the only thing. Wow. All right, so you were preparing for something, all right? So what I want to do is take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about that transition into life, you know, how you really started to form where you are today. All right, we'll take a quick break. All right, it's early in 2016. You just came off a slamming fourth quarter 2015. You're sitting on a boatload of cash, and you're thinking, I want to do something for my business. I want to grow. Start looking at an end foundation. Look at them as building blocks. Build
build, build. Change your categories. Think about gated categories specifically, shoes and clothing. YourSourcedInventory.com, that's what they focus on. You'll get a list every single day of the week, Monday through Friday, and they're going to give you leads for about 10 items that are in the shoes and clothing, and even dipping into the sports and outdoor category, which is great. These are all gated categories. Listen to some of these ranks. In October, the average shoe rank was $7,571 for $29 profit, a return of investment of 88%. December, 11,000 ranking, profit of $32, 83% ROI. Think about that. Profit of $32. What's your average selling price? Imagine what your average selling price would jump to. In clothing, ranking in October, $6,800, profit of $1,488. But listen to this, ROI of 109%. What could you do to get that 109% return? You got to join YourSourcedInventory.com. We use it as foundational in our business. We think you should too. YourSourcedInventory.com. One thing about Jason is he is larger than life. He's a big dude, but he is just hilarious. In this segment, we spend a lot of time, we'll still hash some of the stuff him growing up in that, but I've drawn the conclusion that Jason is the perfect example of somebody who has created a lifestyle. I don't even want to call it a lifestyle business. He's got business. He does business. He travels. He speaks. He sells stuff. He works. But he has a lifestyle. And he's not going to apologize for it. He's going to enjoy it. He's going to embrace it. And that's who he is. The fact that his wife's on board, that's a big bonus. I would say that. That's a really big deal. But it's just so cool to see. And he's going to be a big kid even when he's in his 90s. I can just tell that's his style. So let's get back into the podcast. All right, we're back and we're talking with Jason T. Smith, the thrift hunter fame. He is well known out in circles. You can't miss him if you see him live. Is that fair?
It's very fair. And you know what's funny about that is everyone knows, besides knowing me as Jason T. Smith, everyone knows I am Tiki Pug. That's always been my online name. And a friend wanted to get me a gift the other day, so she Googled Tiki Pug, hoping to find some gift with tikis and pugs. And she said, all I kept seeing was pictures of you everywhere. I go, yeah.
Where'd that come from?
I branded myself quite well, actually.
Wait, where's the love of pugs come from?
Well, it was an accidental love. We, my wife and I had been together. We've been married for 5 years at that point, 5 or 6 years. And we had thought about getting a dog, thought it'd be the next step. Not that we never wanted to have kids, but we thought a dog would be cool. And I wanted a big, hardy dog, like a 100-pound dog. I wanted a dog that I could wrestle with. And then I found out most of those dogs don't live long because they have size issues, and most of them need good exercise. And we lived in a house but in the city, and it just wasn't conducive to an hour of running in the backyard like if you lived in the country. So we were just bouncing around, and we read, pugs like to eat and sleep. Oh, there's my dog right there. There it is. I went from I want to wrestle with you to I want you to just hang out and chill with me.
I notice a pattern. So this is how we chose college, and this is how we put – all right. I think there's a path to least resistance. I think that's a trait for you.
Yeah, I like that. I like that analogy, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's some there. And I don't want to downplay. You do have the thrifting board, and the thrifting board's up to almost 8,000 members. Holy smokes.
I think we're almost at 9,000 now.
Wow. I'm looking at how many people like it. I apologize.
Yeah,
I'm looking
you're looking at yeah.
I got to look at members.
Yeah, we've been at 1,000 every like 21 days, so we're at 8604 right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really something. Yeah. I mean, you got to feel good about that. You know, and no, let's before we get there. Let's go
sure.
back.
Sorry.
Okay.
There
so
was.
you got out of high school, right? You were working at the pizza shop. Did you do anything between while after the pizza shop between that and college?
Well, I actually left my grandparents' pizza shop because, like I said, my uncle felt that he could run the business better than me. Like, you know, it's kind of boss where you would say, hey, we need to do something this way. And he'd just like poo-poo me because I'm 16. And then a day later, he'd go, hey, we're going to do it this way. That's what I said the day before.
Wow.
So I got to the point where I left the family business and worked for Domino's. And they were like within 3 blocks of each other. I went to work for the competition because, A, that's all I knew how to do at that moment. But mm-hmm. B, and I needed money. But, B, I'm like, I can easily transition. So I did. Went to school, worked pizza there, and then unfortunately, or you'll hear it a second, fortunately, I got kicked out of school because, as I already said, I did not go to the classes I needed to fulfill all my academic things that I needed to do. So they said, Jason, thanks for coming. Take 5 years off.
We love you, but
yes, thanks for your money.
This isn't going to work out for a while.
So I went to Bowling Green State University, and if you know that part of the country, it's real near Sandusky, Ohio. And Sandusky, Ohio is famous for Cedar Point, the number one roller coaster amusement park in the world.
Been there. Scary.
And all the people who went to Bowling Green spent the summer working at Cedar Point. And I was talking to a female RA, and I said, hey, did you work at Cedar Point last summer? Yeah, yeah. What's it like? She goes, it's awesome. You work for 8 hours, and the other 16 you party, have sex, and drink. I'm like, sign me up.
Path of least resistance. Boom. I can see it.
Sounds good. And this is a female telling me this. Well, I got kicked out of school. I was still going to go do the job and live on the dorms on Cedar Point. And my folks are like, no, we're pissed. Come home. So they made me come home, and I got my old pizza job back. So I was working 40 hours a week there. And my dad owned a bar. And so he made me work Friday and Saturday night as a bar back. So Friday and Saturday night, I would work like 8 to 10 hours plus my 40. So Fridays I'd work from 10 a.m. to like 4 a.m. every Friday. And so they were pissed, and I didn't have much of a summer, but that's where I met my wife, and it's been almost 26 years now.
That's incredible, though. I mean, you know, you know, teasing you about path of least resistance, but, you know, you have not – it hasn't been easy. I mean, you've been working a long, long time.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, to start really young and to start that work ethic, I'm sure that that's why you've had so much success. Now, so they had a bar.
Yep. Yeah, see, that's another business. I wasn't even thinking about that at the time. But, yeah, my dad and his friends thought, let's open a bar.
Yeah, well, that's always a good business, especially with your friends. That always works out well.
Yeah,
there's never
so
a problem. You know, the financial's easy. Nobody ever gets mad. You know, none of those problems, right? Did your parents – now, I know when I've seen the show that they went to some sales with you. Did they sell before you, or did you teach them how to sell?
Well, my folks, my whole family have always liked antiquing and garage sailing. So I started going out when I was about 6 with my mom, my dad, my grandmother, my uncle, and they would sell at like their own garage sales, but never like as a business. They would just buy what they wanted or needed for the house. And then as they were getting older, and this is a few years ago now, they're both getting ready to retire. And I'm like, come on, you guys are good at garage selling. You should be selling. You know the cool collectibles that I collect, and they collect pretty much the same stuff, all tiki and Hawaiian. I said, so flip your excess. Come on. So I taught them eBay, and they both retire, and they're 73 now, and they're so into eBay. I'm having my mom come out. I'm going on vacation in April. I'm having my mom come out to watch my dogs while I'm gone, and she goes, oh, I want to see you too. I'm like, all right, we'll stay a couple weeks. And she goes, I got to get back to eBay. And so they do it well, and I've got them hooked. But what a great thing to get your parents hooked on when they're retired, making their own money after retirement. And so they had done well in putting away for their retirement, and their money guy said, look, at your spending rate, you'll run on money when you're 95, and that's not counting what they're making on eBay. So
think about that. How many 73-year-olds, right, go look in their neighborhood, how many are that active?
Oh yeah, I mean, if you see or meet my folks, they're very young, 73, looking and acting. They're laying around a pool drinking rum in Key West right now as we speak.
But I mean, I don't want to downplay that point. They're out there learning how to buy, right? Learning. I mean, there's so much thought when you're out there buying things to sell, right?
Yep.
That things that really sell. I mean, not things to buy. I mean, it's easy to buy crap. It's not easy to buy things to sell. So. That will sell. I guess I should say it that way. So here they are out there doing that. That takes a lot of mental clarity. But then the backside of eBay, it's not as easy. You know, it's easier today than what it was for sure. But it's still a lot going on. And to keep active and they enjoy it, man, that's what keeps people young.
Oh, absolutely. And they, you know, it's kind of a model that I've done a speech with. I was doing a speech at an event in Chicago, and I said, hey, do we got any extra time in the event? They're like, we got 15 minutes. I'm like, can I bring my parents up for 15 minutes? I think it'll be good, not so much for the people that are there, but for those people's parents or grandparents. And I said, here's my mom and dad. Here's the kind of sales they're doing on a monthly basis, and they're doing it part-time. They watch my nieces a couple days a week. But my mom and dad source together. Dad does all the picture taking. My mom does all the listing. Then dad does all the shipping, and mom does all the correspondence. And it's a great match.
It's a great match, but again, look at how many couples communicate at that age, right? Usually they see each other for, you know, one's going down to the coffee house, right? And the other one's with their knitting. You know, I just love You know, I can see that. Do you think you pattern your life around that in some ways?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My parents have been a huge influence on me. I mean, of course, every parent is, but I definitely see myself as them as I get older, too. Like, they've always loved life and loved their kids. And even when times were lean, they would figure out a way to take us on vacation and show us a fun time. And, you know, I didn't know those things then, but my grandparents owned a condo in Florida, and they would be, you know, they'd be snowbirds. They go down to Florida in the winter, and we go visit every winter. And so my grandfather was dying unbeknownst to us grandkids and maybe had one or so years left in him. And I think my parents pawned their wedding rings to take us on one last vacation so we could spend it with my grandfather.
Wow.
And, you know, knowing that now, I have definitely tried to repay. You know, I've taken – my wife and I have taken both our parents on many vacations over the last 10, 12 years because we're in a position to do that. And just to thank them for not just birthing us, but, you know, raising us the right way, I feel, you know. I think my wife and I have a good, smart outlook on life and how you should live it, and as due to our parents. And so – I like to. It's fun. We took them. It's fun and frustrating. When you take 4 7-year-olds to Hawaii, it's like herding 4 slow cats. But it was so nice to see all 4 of them just away from the daily distractions that they do normally deal with, just sitting in paradise, laying by the pool in the cabana. I mean, it tickled us to be able to do it for them. And so I thank them for that and what they did for us when we were younger.
Very, very cool. All right, so we move forward, right? So now you get booted from school. You're at Cedar Point. You're finding
– Oh, no, I never made it. They made me come home. I got the job, but they made me
–
And I got the job being a carnival barker. I mean, that's so me. Come on, win your girlfriend a teddy bear. Let's do this. Come on, big fella. You can knock the milk bottles over.
You could also be that clown that they have that's sitting up on the thing, you know, trying to – go ahead, knock me in. Come on, buddy. You've seen those carnival guys. You could be that guy.
Speaking of clowns and other jobs, I won an award as most valuable monster at a haunted house one year. I was the most awesome evil clown ever.
Oh, my God.
So imagine this. Imagine my size coming at you with full evil clown makeup, blood dripping, bullet holes, the whole works.
Yeah, there's no chance. I'd never be the same. I'd be in therapy for a long time.
People cry.
Okay, so you ended up though in Hollywood. How did you get from Ohio to Hollywood?
It was I worked for a chain of CD stores in Cleveland, so that was my last career in Ohio.
God, remember CD stores?
Yeah.
Oh.
And the guy I worked for had stores in Cleveland where he started. He had branched to 3 or 4 in Detroit and 2. And was building a third in Pittsburgh. So I went to work for him as an assistant manager, and I quickly moved up the ranks, and I loved it, and I needed to make a career out of it. And when they were switching from pen and paper to computers. So I was the guy who could talk to the programmer and explain in his language what we needed, and I was the guy that could talk to the 16-year-old working the counter and how this is going to work. Because don't forget, this is 1998. Oh. So, you know, it's the birth of using the internet and computers, really, you know. And so, ultimately, we go from pen and paper to computer. So, I taught them all how to do it. And I kind of worked myself out of a job. So, I spent over a year working around the 3 states, transferring the stores over from pen and paper to computer, got the whole store inventoried. So, you could be in Pittsburgh and seeing what the Detroit inventory was. So,
wow.
So if you had a customer. And we built this from scratch. There was nothing.
I was going to say, that's really impressive for back then.
Yeah, so there was nothing so like this on the market. So we did it. So we knew it would be awesome. And I was getting a nice salary, had a company car, expense account. And we finished the last store, and there was still work for me to do. But by that point, I think, this is just my personal thought, they were like, well, he's making too much. So they said, we're not going to use it anymore. And that was March of 2000, and I was depressed. It was one of the first times I'd ever felt real depression. Up until that moment, I was always like, oh, just shake it off. What's depression? But I was bummed because I loved that job. I loved everybody I worked with. I worked with every staff in 3 states. I loved it, and I was very depressed. But my wife did something cool. I was getting unemployment for 6 months, and she did not make me go get a job right away. And she's like, just figure out what you want to do. And I spent the summer golfing with my boys, having a good time. But that's when I started selling online. I started figuring out online selling. And cut to September of 2000, she calls me and she goes, hey, the company offered me to go to Long Beach, California, and they'll pay to move us. let's talk about it when I get home. I hung up, up with her, and I'm like, wait a minute, I can escape Cleveland winters before my search is won. She got home.
Any town with the name Beach in it sounds good.
She got home, and I was already packing. I'm like, let's get out of here. They're paying for the move? Hell yeah. So she said, all right. So a couple weeks later, she had to leave before we were even ready to move. She had to be there. So she left. I packed up the house and followed her out to Long Beach, and we were there 2 years, moved up to Santa Monica for 2 years, and ended up working in Hollywood.
Well, you know, what were you selling when you first started on e-commerce? What was the stuff that you had?
It was CDs. So I got laid off from the one CD chain, and I was in this cool independent store that used to be a big deal in Cleveland called Record Rev, Record Revolution. It was there in the 60s with all the hippies. It was there in the 80s with all the punks. And they had a table. This is spring of 2000. They had a table of dollar promo CDs. They weren't all promos, but most were. And Half.com had just been born, for those of you who know Half.com. And so I was buying a lot of this stuff off the table for a buck, and I was flipping it for like $8. But I was doing it like 100 times, 200 times, 300 times, 400 times a month. And I'm like, hey, I like this online selling stuff. I don't got to shower. I don't got to go anywhere. As long as I got stuff to sell, I can make money. And that's what really started for me. It was so... You know, looking back, getting fired was the best thing that ever happened. I got to move to Hollywood. I got to learn how to fend for myself, basically.
Well, and it sounds to me, again, you know, looking, you know, you stayed in the music business in some way. And so it's all related again. I mean, and I think that there's a common trait among successful sellers. A lot of them have something built way back and they bring it forward. And I think this is a good example. Okay, so you're in Hollywood, but you're not, you know, this is when, I mean, Tower Records was the place. It was hot.
Oh, absolutely.
So let's talk about, you know, what your role was there, what your experience was, and then, you know, were you able to take that to any e-commerce method or not?
Yeah, so I was I worked for one of the biggest independent record stores in Long Beach when we moved to Long Beach. Now, my wife got there before I did, and so she was staying in corporate housing until we found a place, and then I was packing up the house. And she goes, hey, I was hanging out on 2nd Street, and 2nd Street is in the Belmont Shore of Long Beach. It's kind of like the hip street. It's where all the bars, restaurants, shops are. And she goes, there's this great record store that has so much stacks of crap, it gives me the heebie-jeebies, but you'll love it. So I said, cool. So I went down there, and I'm like, hey, I'm looking for work. And he's like, well, I don't have any positions right now. I'm like, hey, do you sell online? He goes, nope. I go, let me sell online for you. I'll show you how to make money online. He said, oh, okay. So give me a job. So I sat in the back and I just sold online. So when my wife got transferred to Santa Monica and we moved up there, I'm like, I was still driving back to Long Beach. I'm like, that ain't happening. For those of you who have ever driven the 405 at rush hour, you will fully appreciate this.
Mm-hmm.
So my friend was managing the Tower Records in Westwood, which is UCLA. And Tower was already in trouble, unbeknownst to me. So they were trying out a new thing. They changed the word from Tower, oddly enough, to Pugs. And they added used products and bringing in used records and buying stuff. So I went to work for there, and I worked for them for quite a while. And they decided to close that shop up. And so there was the night manager position was open in Hollywood. So it is now 2001, and I've become the night manager at Tower Records in Hollywood. 2001, you were not downloading music, you were not pirating music, and you were barely buying music online. So if you were famous and you wanted something from a record store, you had to go to the record store.
Right, and let's face it, Tower is the big name.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely. I mean, and right in Hollywood on Sunset Boulevard, it was the place to be.
Would you? Was there paparazzi back then?
There was, but it didn't come to our front door too often. We did two huge in-stores, and that was the only time. We did a Mariah Carey and a Ricky Martin at the height of the Ricky Martin-ness, and other than that, it wasn't, you know, if the store was there today, there TMZ would be parked outside of it all day.
Yeah, that's what I would think. They would just rent space across the street and just put Lens in there.
Every day I help somebody famous, and some from time to time look so haggard. Like I was ringing out Tommy Chong once of Cheech and Chong fame, had no clue it was him. And my buddy saw me ringing him out, paged me, and I kind of looked at him across the store and went, I'm ringing out a customer. He goes, pick up the page. So I picked it up. I go, yes, I'm busy. He goes, you know you're ringing out Tommy Chong, right? I go, no, I'm not. He goes, yes, you are. So when Tommy handed me his credit card, I'm like, ooh, life's
tough, cool.
Tommy.
Yeah, he said put away wet. So you really did get to see a lot. Did you collect anything back then?
A couple things. Music, which I still have my whole CD collection that numbers a little over 4,000 downstairs. So I am not the one to put it all on my computer and then get rid of my CDs. I still have my whole collection. But at the time, my wife and I had been collecting hippos and rhinos. So our whole house was filled with everything hippo and rhino. And I had my first tattoo when I was like 19, which is Marvin the Martian. You know, typical 19-year-old tattoo. Look through the book. I like that. And so I collected Marvin the Martian stuff too, and so we always were on the hunt for cool CDs, cool Marvin stuff, and cool hippo and rhino stuff.
All right, so you worked there for how long? Did you work in Hollywood?
I was there for about a year. Went on vacation with my wife, came back, and the manager who I worked under, who I loved, and who was also named Jason, made life easy. He had been let go. In his place was this female manager who. Was a weird person in retail. She wore like 6-inch stiletto heels every day to walk a retail floor, which I thought was nuts. And she was very much pro-woman, anti-man. And so when I got back from this vacation, women who were behind me on the depth chart got promoted in front of me. Now, don't take that as I don't think a woman could be promoted in front of me at all. My wife is way smarter than me, hands down to her. So, but I was just pissed. Like, that person worked for us for a month, and now they're ahead of me? What the hell? So my wife happened to get a job offer from a bigger company, getting paid more money, and I said, "Oh, can I quit?" She called me at work. She said, "Yep," and I walked in the back. I said, "Here's my 2 weeks. Gotta go."
All right. So you left there.
Yeah, and then I went back. So at that point, I was doing eBay full time. So we were living in Santa Monica. I was sourcing from all the record stores all over the LA basin. And
was that your focus, was music again?
Yeah.
Music related?
Yeah, I hadn't branched at really much at all at that point.
What kind of music was it the music you liked, or were you staying current with the whatever the trend was?
Neither, actually. It was everything, because I developed my niche quickly and well, that I knew out of print, I knew rare. I would sell normal, you know, current releases, $8-$9, but man, I love finding the rare things that would sell for the, I've sold $500 CDs in the past.
Well, and I've heard you say that, you know, and it was one of the things that I've always wanted to ask you, you know, how do you know? I mean, I understand that there's some things you just know, right? You just got to know,
yep.
Right? It's unusual. You know, I know punk rock sells. I get it, because they didn't produce a lot of it, and the weirder, the better, blah, blah, blah. I get that. But there's a lot of things, you know, what makes this record, this CD, this whatever, more popular or more, you know, I'm in Pennsylvania, and I remember finding a Motown type of record, but it was from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. That's where it was produced. And I could tell, you know, it's just unusual. You know, that was unusual. So that stood out to me. But what are you looking for to give some people some clues on what makes something unusual?
Well, there's a couple things.
Music-wise.
There's a couple of things. Back in the late 90s, late 80s, early 90s, when CDs started, there was a company called Mobile Fidelity Sound Labs. And what they did was they were the first to take normal popular releases and make high-end audiophile versions of them. And majority of the releases were – the discs were 24-karat gold-plated.
No kidding.
Yeah. And so they were expensive at the time. The company didn't last, and so – those would have been collectibles anyway, but once the company went out of business, made each release rarer than the other. And so I would hunt for those, because a lot of stores would be, especially if it was a used store run, and there was a 16-year-old working the counter, they didn't know nor cared. So my first major success, big success, was I bought a CD by Mobile Fidelity Sound Labs at a record store in Santa Monica. And I paid $14, and I knew they had mispriced it. They thought it was the regular, normal Woodstock soundtrack release. When Mobile Fidelity Sound Labs did it, they did both part one and part two and put it in one package.
And can you, I mean, today, when you see it, do you know it? I mean, can you look at a big stack and say,
oh, there's one?
Oh,
yeah. When my wife watches me, she'll see me pull out things that just have no reason to be pulled out. And she goes, "Why'd you pull those out?" I'm like, they just spoke to me. And now, nowadays, it's super duper easy to double check with your smartphone. And
I
would say I'm right probably 75% of the time, which it sounds like, geez, you're wrong 25%. I'll definitely grab way more than I think, just because there are a few that I'm like, oh, wait, that's hot. I didn't even know what that was, but I'll grab everything that looks interesting that I don't know and just quickly scan them.
That's so cool.
But going back to that CD, I threw up on eBay at auction and let it roll. I found out it was worth $200. Two guys got into a pissing contest, and the winner paid me $404.
Wow.
And the best part, Stephen, he lived 2 miles from the store. I paid $14 for it.
You know, you think about all that stuff that was in that Tower Records, you know, that today is worth a fortune, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, you just think about, you know, imagine if you could stick away, you know, pop culture that you know will be hot. I mean, it's just interesting. So, okay, so you went full time into eBay, and your wife has a pretty big career. It's been been very successful.
Yep.
Does that allow you to take chances that most people don't get the luxury of taking, do you think?
Absolutely, and I always say that when I'm speaking to a group about doing this, because I see a lot of people who want to do what I do or what any of us do that's online full time. And it can be done. It definitely can be done. We have many, many people in our circles that have done it very successfully, some to the levels that you never would even have thought possible. But I remind them, especially when I see a couple want to do it together, I said, look, I have a wife that has a great job with great benefits. So I have a little more leeway and a little less fear, because if I have a bad day or don't find anything good or don't sell anything good today, it doesn't matter, so to speak. It matters, but the lights are going to stay on in my house. And so I warn people, like, don't forget, you got to make sure that your basic needs will be covered. And when I say basic needs, there'll be a roof over your house, the electricity will be on, and if you need to go to the doctor, you can afford to go to the doctor.
I see people out there, you know, hey, you know, can I do this job full time? I need to make six figures. And I'm thinking to myself, ooh, you ought to ratchet down your life before you try an e-commerce business, because you're not going to see – it's possible. Don't get me wrong. Lots of people do.
Oh, yeah.
Sustaining it, that's the art. You know, let's see them a year from now or 2 years from now, because it gets old. I mean, there are parts of this becomes work. It is a four-letter word in some ways, right? There's some ups and some downs, and it gets to be a job sometimes if you let it. It doesn't sound to me, and tell me if I'm correct in this, that this has become a job for you in any way.
Never. And that's why I'm so glad that – I am glad that I married well, because I did go work a job, and not a career, but a job here in Vegas. For, you know, it's one of those where I'm going to help a friend out one day at his job and turn into working for him. And my wife kept saying, don't do it. Working for a friend never works out. And, of course, I call her the voice of reason. It didn't work out. And when I finally quit that next month, I went back eBay full time, and I made just as much sitting around in my underwear that I did the month before, which was backbreaking work. I'm like, what was I?
Don't give me the vision. I don't need what? That. Let's just not go there.
I'm like, what was I doing busting my ass for the same money I could make on my own? That was stupid. Stupid.
But so you've really created a lifestyle. And how long have you been in the lifestyle, would you say? I mean, how long has this lifestyle been? What year did you start this not free, but where you kind of set your own pace? How long?
So that
what year
was
did you start?
About 9 years ago.
So 9 years ago.
Yeah.
So you're here on 9 years later, and you've had some real success with Thrift Hunters. And, you know, you're 9 years later. Would you change anything?
Small parts of it, but for the most part, no. And like you said, I don't treat it as a job. I say this all the time, like the position I'm in, and it's more than just selling. I've positioned myself as a leader in the community. I love to get up every day. Like, I don't like to sleep in. I live in Vegas, and I'd rather go to bed so I can get up early. Like, I get up, I grab my iPad, and I look for three things. What have I sold overnight? Who's asking for help? And who has shared a success story because of the help that either I or my group has given them? That's what gets me up in the morning, and that's a great way to wake up. Like,
oh my gosh, yeah. How can you not? Every one of those things are inspiring.
Everyone, and it's so great. Like, I get messages all the day, and the good thing about, you know, Thrift Hunters only lasted two seasons, but it was sold worldwide, and it still repeats in every country but this damn one. And so almost every other day I get a message from some country. So last week I've gotten messages from Holland and Australia, the UK, and Turkey. Fans of the show want to know more. I'm doing it in this country. Can you give me any guidance? And I always, you know, direct them to my Facebook group and my new YouTube show. But it is so that's what's great, is that I've connected with people all over the world, And I did nothing more than just what I would do anyway. I just happened to have a film crew follow me.
Well, you know, that came about. How did that come about? Let's talk about that.
Well, it comes about the same way Arabelle gets TV shows. They just call you and say, hey, you want to be on TV? No, that's not the normal way, but that's how it happened for me. They just called one day and said, we want to make a thrifting show. Would you like to be it?
Well, how did they find you?
So they were searching around the internet for thrifters. A production company had seen pawn shows and picking shows, but nobody was doing a thrifting show. So purely hitting the thrift stores, hitting the garage sales, hitting the flea markets. And so when they checked Google or when they checked YouTube or when they checked Facebook, I kept showing up. And so they're like, well, if this is the guy that's showing up, let's call him. And so already back then, and this has been a few years now, I had branded myself well enough that when somebody was hunting, they found me.
Hmm. Yeah, that's, you know, there's all that good that you've done, too. That comes back and helps too. You know, you really have prepared for that. Again, I think, you know, again, we're seeing that common trait, you know. So Thrift Hunter was on for 2 years and or two seasons.
Yep.
And since then, I mean, you're still a seller. All that time, you know, you were selling, and I always see the pictures of your assistant who just left. But I always see those pictures in the background. That was real. The stuff you bought was real,
yep.
Correct?
Yep.
You and Brian, that was real deal. You guys went out, bought real stuff. Sold real stuff. I saw the stuff for sale. I've seen some of your stuff online for sale. And, I mean, of course, not everything's a success, but they're going to show the successes, I'm sure. That's just probably better TV.
Oh, yeah. And that's what people used to call BS, because let me tell you. I'll tell you right now that almost all the shows but ours, they're all fake. The picking shows, the pawn shows. I mean, we could do a whole thing on Pawn Stars and, you know, how they stage it, how they set it. My friend works in their back room one day. They're like, okay, you bought this paint at a flea market. You're going to sell for $5,000. Come on, let's go. It was horrible. But when they asked us to do the show, I said, at the time I was 42, I said, do I want to be on TV and possibly famous at 42? Absolutely. I love being on stage. But at 42, do I have any interest in making bullshit fake TV? Nope. And they said, well, it's good to know because we don't make reality TV. We make documentary type TV. Like, we're going to follow you and do what you do. But of course, we're still making TV. So we got to show the big successes. We got to edit it to make it fun. And people would piss and moan saying it's fake. And I'm like, you can follow me any day. I can find good stuff anywhere. And like, as you just said, you saw the stuff for sale on my eBay store. And, you know, we had some friends film with us and we would obviously film in stores. They're like, well, of course it's fake. They know you're filming. Duh, we're not making guerrilla TV. We are, yes, you do have to call the thrift store and go, hey, can we film in there? Yes.
Yeah, there has to be some.
Of course you have
right.
to do that, but when we walked in the store, there was nothing else preset. Like, whatever was there that day was there that day. So we just started shopping, and we find the good stuff. And, you know, we shop 5 stores per episode, and out of those 5 stores, we probably each bought a couple hundred things, and out of those couple hundred, there's always going to be a good handful. They're going to be real, what we call the big ticket items. Not always huge money, but maybe something very fun or unique or different. And those are the ones we would focus on. Of course, that's how you make TV.
So tell me about your process, right? So you would go out and buy these things. And it doesn't even have to really pertain to win this show. But you were buying some pretty heavy quantity of items.
Mm-hmm.
What's the process when you're coming back to your place? How did that work?
So usually I would come back and separate everything into like things. So, you know, we kind of skipped this part, but I went from music to everything. Because one day I had an epiphany. I'm standing in a thrift store. I just combed the music section, and it was a really big thrift store. And I went, I bet you there's some other cool stuff I could sell in here.
Yeah. That 6-foot area, maybe I should step outside of it just a little bit.
And
right?
This was a huge one. This had taken over like a large Office Depot space or something. It was huge, like Kmart size. And so,
where was this at?
This was in Vegas. It was their first big Savers, and then there's even a bigger one since then. So yeah. I just started selling everything. So my process when I got home was I'd separate it, and I would tub everything, so it'd be easy to work. Because if you work – I know this is going to sound stupidly easy, but it took me a while to figure this one out. If you work on the same type of product on a day, it goes so much quicker. So if I'm not flipping between a pair of jeans and a T-shirt and a CD, if I do all CDs today – all jeans tomorrow, all T-shirts on Wednesday, it goes so much quicker. So I would tub it all. So here's the jeans tub. Here's the purse tub. Here's the CD tub. Here's the toy tub. And then I would just set it off to the side. And at the time, I wasn't using a ton of space in my house because I didn't have – I mean, I always have a couple hundred items for sale. And now between Amazon and eBay, I always have like 1,500. But if I had a shelf that was dwindling, so say my T-shirt shelf was kind of lax, then I would go list T-shirts. And if my jeans shelf was lax, I go list jeans. And that was kind of the process. Well, I got to the point where I grew beyond that. And so we just keep, we still do the process of one type of item at a time, but it's not based on what needs to be filled. We just keep on listing and keep on selling.
When did you decide to bring on a helper?
And this is a tip I always tell people. If you want to take your business to the next level, the assistant is the first part, because especially if you're doing eBay, you can teach any monkey how to take pictures. And that is not a derogatory thought on any of my assistants, but anybody can be told, you set the item up this way, you push this button. And then repeat that about 50 times, and we'll be done with this stuff. So, because that's a lot of time. Once you take that time out of your day, you have all this extra time to work on your listings or work on sourcing more or anything else. And then you bring the assistant into, here's how to list, here's how to ship. And by the point, like you just said, I lost my assistant. He was great because he was at the point early on that I could just come and go. And I travel quite a bit, once or twice a month, for both pleasure and for speaking engagements, that I didn't have to think about anything other than, here's what I want you to work on while I'm gone. I always gave him more work than he could even handle. But that way, I never had to think about it nor worry about it. He could ship, he could list, he could do it all, and I didn't have to focus any part of my day on worrying about what was going on in my office.
Will you hire a replacement for him?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. So you've just become that. You know, and I was thinking about that. I think it's because you've created, again, that lifestyle, right? You get to do the things that you like in the business when you want. So sometimes I'm sure there's some times you want to take some pictures, right? And you get into it a little bit, or you want to ship, or you want to, you know, obviously source and stuff like that. I think that's a great example. Probably doesn't, again, it doesn't become a job.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I think that's smart.
And I know it's always going to happen, because look, I could have a full-time assistant, but I'm always good with just part-time. As long as the office stays running and everything gets shipped, I'm good. But I do enjoy that I've seen every assistant go on to bigger and better things for themselves. It's sad, and I know it's always going to happen, but it's been great. My first assistant became a lawyer. So she went from working in my spare bedroom to be a lawyer. My second took a job with a big pay raise and full benefits where her husband worked, so they're able to carpool together. And my third one, she had a major career, and her company got downsized in the recession, and she unfortunately was in the cuts. So she learned how to sell by being my assistant. And then as soon as she was helping season two of Thrift Hunters, and as soon as we were done filming, she's like, I need to go do this on my own, but, you know, thanks. And so she became quite a successful online seller, and she moved into Amazon FBA. But we live 2 minutes apart. We're still friends. She still has a key. If I'm in need, she'll pop over here and ship for me.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
You know, you came to speak at a group I was at, I think it was a couple of years ago in Baltimore, and it was a meetup group. And it was just so incredible and so impressive, because, you know, the things like you were talking about with the shirt, you know, hey, nobody needs to see the picture of the shirt as your main image. They know it's a shirt, otherwise they wouldn't be buying it. They want to see the image on the shirt, right? So the common sense things, but when you point them out, everybody else has already done it the other way, right? And so you gave some amazing tips. How did you become a speaker, really pushing eBay?
Well, it was quite by accident, but it was to fulfill my own needs and wants, oddly enough. So eBay Radio was a big event. They have a big event here in Vegas every summer for a couple of days. And when they were starting to have the events, I lived here already. And I said, hey, look, I know what goes on in hotels in this town. They charge you an arm and a leg to get a little tiny box from point A to point B. Why don't you have all your speakers to ship the boxes to my house? I'll throw them into my SUV. And when you get to town, I'll just bring them up in one swoop. We'll throw them on a bell cart. You can take them away. And that'll save you and the vendors hundreds of dollars. So they're like, oh, thanks, yeah, that's great. So we would do that every year. And so like 2 or 3 years into it, I had an idea. I had an epiphany. And I collect all things tiki, but mainly tiki mugs. And I have a huge collection. And if you don't know what a tiki mug is, back in the day and still today, you would go to a tiki bar, order a drink, and you would take the mug home. And the mugs would be different shapes, different colors, but all based around the tiki culture. So I had this idea. I'm like, I would like to do a 15-minute speech on all things tiki. And so here was my thought. I have all these friends across the country and the world that are in the tiki scene as much as me. And we all go out and we all hunt for cool stuff. And I thought, I have a way to build a better mousetrap. I'm going to teach 200 people how to look for me. you can fuel my obsession and my collection because I can't be everywhere. But if I got somebody looking for me in like Montana, Chicago, Florida, like I'll have a leg up on all the, my friends who are my competition. And so they told me, well, we don't have any extra time. Sorry, all the speakers are full. And I was bummed. I'm like, okay. So in the meantime, I had birthed with Brian our first Facebook group, 13 with the Boys, and it was going quite well. And we'd done a couple classes. And I asked my friend again. I said, I don't want to be a pain, but can we talk about thrifting? Like, I'll make it bigger. I think it's something awesome. So they and I was kind of calling in my favor. Like, you know, like I've done this. I've been in your receiving department for 2 years.
Right.
Like, let me call my chip in. And they said, all right, here's the deal. We will give you 45 minutes before day two. I said, I'll take it. Now, let's think about where we're at. We're in Vegas. 200 people came to Vegas. They live in Poughkeepsie or Buffalo or wherever, and they're partying. You know, nothing closes here. You can party and gamble and drink all night long. So before day two, people are a little haggard because they got there 2 nights before, so they partied. They already partied a few nights. So at 8 minutes before we were supposed to start, there was 8 people sitting there looking at us. I said, I'll take it, whatever. But we knew we were onto something because by the time we started, 8 minutes later, there was 100 people sitting there.
No kidding.
They were all, you know, kind of hungover, kind of tired, and it was a successful speech. And I was hooked from that moment on being on stage, but talking about something that's going to help somebody else make their business better or make them more money or give them freedom.
Well, and you've really evolved now, right? You don't just talk about eBay. You really are really talking about life in some ways, right? Some inspirational stuff.
Yep, yep.
How's that going?
It's great. I talked about thrifting for quite a while on eBay, and I got hired to speak at a dinner here in Vegas. And I said, hey, I've been toying with the idea of doing my first inspirational speech. And I had an infection in my arm that almost made me lose my arm and maybe almost killed me. And those are moments I had clarity of how to fix my life and get to the point now where I enjoy waking up. And so I said, I'd like to talk about that. And, you know, it a lot of times when people talk, and if you know John Lawson, same way,
sure,
everything he says seems like, well, duh. But until you hear it sometimes, it just doesn't click. Like, well, duh, I should probably shop more than just the music section in the thrift store. But, you know, for whatever reason, you just get stuck in your lane sometimes. And
right,
so
right.
I gave a speech and it went over quite well. And I've done that speech a few times. And of course, I still talk. I'll go someplace and talk just about how to sell better or thrift. But I've been kind of weaving the two together now. You know?
Well, I think there's a relationship, right? I mean, you just sit back and you say to yourself, because you have figured out that an e-commerce business can be a lifestyle. Right. I don't most people, I don't think, you know, those first question, hey, what do you want? More money. I don't think most people really want more money. They want freedom.
Yep.
And so I can see that, you know, the e-commerce business and that freedom, that lifestyle that you've been able to create, I can see that they're interwoven. And I think it is a great story. And I think there's a lot of people can relate because that's what they want. Really. That's what they really want.
Yeah. And, you know, it's the most, you know, you said, would you go back and change anything? Yeah, I would tweak a couple things here or there, but here's why I wouldn't change anything. And I didn't expect this. You know, it's one of those things where, look, I just wanted to teach 200 people how to find Tiki mugs for me. Now, the great thing, to go back to that for a second, is I now have thousands of people that look around the world for me. and I have Tiki friends who hate me, who won't talk to me anymore because they think it's bullshit that I've created an army. I go, hey, man, I just figured out a way to build a better mousetrap.
It's funny you say that because not that long ago, I was in an antique mall and I took a picture and sent it to you. And it was of a tiki. I don't remember what it was. And I'm like, what the heck is this? So I sent you, I texted you the picture and you wrote back, where is that? You know, it's just funny how exactly what you're describing. The minute I saw it, I thought of you. That was
yeah.
It. Top of mind.
Same.
Jason Smith. I bet you he doesn't have this one or whatever. You know, it's just interesting that you say that because I can relate to that.
So getting into it, it was a selfish reason for me. Now, what I didn't know was going to happen, as happened many times over, was I've changed people's lives. And it sounds kind of conceited, but between my Facebook help and online help and my TV shows, there have been people that at events came up to me and hugged me and cried because they've said, what we've learned from you, we were able to keep the power on in our house. Or my husband broke his back, couldn't work, disability was only covering like 3/4 of our bills. He has one good hour a day, but listening to you, what you sell and how you sell it, his one good hour a day is used taking pictures. I get the things listed and sold, and because of that, we're able to keep our head above the water. Now, I was not expecting that at all.
You gave a B plan, right? People don't have a B plan, right? Most people don't have a B plan in life. Back then when we were kids, right, it was stuff in envelopes, right, that I had in the back of the magazines, right? Stuff envelopes from home, right? That, you really didn't have a B plan. You couldn't have a B plan. Or a paper route was one way, right? That was one thing. And, you know, once they switched to adults, you know, deliver papers overnight and then go to your 9-to-5. So the fact that you've been able to help people understand that there is a B plan, it's just an effort. And I just gave somebody advice today is that 90% of people won't do anything. So if you just take action, you're ahead of 90%, right?
Yep.
And so that's a really cool story. So you've now the show's over. You're still selling, of course.
Yep.
But and you're speaking lots of different places. I think I saw I think there's two or three events I'm going to, and you're one of the speakers at two or three events that I'm going to. And you, though, wanted to keep the show was kind of going, and you have a new show. And tell us about that.
Yeah, so my actual TV show had ended, and I was speaking in Philadelphia at an event for e-commerce sellers. And after the event was over, I had a friend who lived in Philly, and she was kind of showing me and Chris Green and a few others around town. So basically, we were using her as our private taxi because she had a little SUV. And on the last day, I had about 2 hours before my flight, and I said, hey, I was Google mapping thrift stores, and there's one right by the airport. Now, she lives in Philly, and she goes, there's a thrift store by our airport? I go, yeah, and I showed her where it was. She goes, oh, that's a rough part of town. I go, well, I'm a big dude. Let's go. So I go, I find the best stuff in ghetto thrift stores all the time. So we go over there. It's the first thrift store where the parking lot was surrounded by chain link and barbed wire. I'm like, well, we are sweetly in the ghetto. So we thrifted, found some great stuff, and my previous partner was kind of like me, big dude, was a dude, single, you know, we kind of had some of the same tastes. So I'm thrifting with my buddy, and I give him his plane, so I got this five-hour plane ride home, and I'm thinking about things, and just whirling through my head. I'm like, I'm going to create a YouTube show, and two things. I've been on all my friends' YouTube shows. They're all, they have good content, but they're all kind of boring, and they all kind of meander, and I'm going to make Nadine, my friend, my new partner. Now, the difference is, she's a woman and a mother, and she's cute and smells a lot better than Brian did. So, but I thought different angles. Like, I don't know kids' clothes. I don't know girl, right. I know some girly stuff. Like, I'm really good at dresses, purses, bras, but I don't know, like, girly shoes. I don't know what's hot for girly tops right now. I don't know that stuff. So I thought, this would be fun. She's cute. She's nice. And she can bring way different stuff to the table than I could. So I get off this plane. I call her. I said, got this idea. Now, she is not like me. She does not crave the spotlight. She does not want to be on camera. And she goes, no way. I go, trust me. Trust me. It's going to be cool. So we got it off the ground. And I said, her name is Nadine. Mine is Jason. I go, we're going to call it Thrifty Business with a J and A. Kind of a, you know, kind of a sing-songy kind of title. And I said, here's how we're going to structure it. It'll be an hour show. First half hour will be segments, and we'll have artwork for each segment, and it'll be quick segments like shipping tip, thrifting tip, scores of the week. And then the second half hour will be a guest with a specific reason why they're there, and we'll talk to them about the reason they're there. And so it'll be kind of like a nighttime talk show for the thrifting world and for the eBay world. And we did two practice shows, and she was kind of like, I don't know. And now she loves doing it. It's one of her high points of her life and her day, because also she has breast cancer, and she's dealing with that right now. So she has found a voice, and she's helping lead other women, especially younger, to get checked to make sure they're okay. So besides the fact that she is a good thrifter and a good seller, and we can share those tips, she has found a vehicle to help. So she went from being somebody who did not want to be on camera to, I can't wait to my weekly show to make sure I'm helping others.
It's just awesome.
I'm just saying that, and I live it. I know it.
But again, it's, you know, one thing leads to another. Yep. I mean, it's just taking you to this place. I interviewed Dan Miller, right? And he's famous. You know, he had a radio show for all these years, and he said that he used to be on terrestrial radio for 6 years, and he's now on his own podcast. And he said, it gives me so much more freedom to do what I want to do instead of listen to some radio station manager telling me I got to do it this way. And he just loves the freedom. And I can see it in what you guys are doing. You get to kind of do probably some of the stuff that you wanted to do, even with the TV show, but they said no, right? Somebody else made a decision.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So don't get it twisted. When you're on TV, unless your last name is Kardashian or a Real Housewife, when you're on reality TV, it's not about what you want to do. Even though the show is about you and is you, you're the last man on the totem pole. You are the last man.
What do you think's next? I mean, so, you know, I guess I was sitting here thinking about this, and I'm like, Jason would be a good person to ask, what do we see happening in the e-commerce world, right? So you know, I did interview John Lawson, and John gave some really, you know, powerful advice about, you know, using landing pages to really sell your product, individual pages. I mean, it was just so smart when I think about what he said. What do you think is happening with the e-commerce world? You know, I mean, eBay has gotten easier to sell on for a lot of ways, right? Especially with the app, right? You could take a picture, you could kind of do it in a minute sitting at an auction if you wanted to. You could literally list that item. But it's got challenges too.
Yeah.
Amazon is easy in some ways, and it's so complicated in other ways. There's so much more cost. Postage, right, even just personally, postage has gone through the roof, right, shipping and that kind of thing. What do you think is happening next?
You know, and this is kind of leads into – I'm speaking at ASD for the first time. They asked me to speak next month, and when I was talking to the girl in charge of education, she goes, I need a good eBay seller, and obviously you're it. What can you talk about? She kind of put me on the spot. She's like, give me your presentation now. And she had just asked me. I just said yes. I'm like, okay, hang on. Let me think. Because now I'm thinking, all right, I can't be just – you know I'm there to talk about eBay. At ASD, it's all these sellers from all over the world buying wholesale to flip. And I'm like, okay, so I got to think of something really important, so to speak. And I said, okay. And I was talking – oddly enough, John Loss works in this. I was talking to John about it. Even though the world is evolving and changing on a daily basis in e-commerce, and you should move and evolve with those changes, I think you need to stay in your lane. And what I mean by that is dance with the one who brought you. So I see all my friends are like, ooh, I'm going to try this. Ooh, I'm going to try that. Ooh, I'm going to try that. And then they don't ever master anything, and they spread themselves too thin, and they're never successful. Never. And Chris Green is the opposite of that. Like, he can try every new thing, and it becomes successful for him. So do not pattern it thinking you're going to be a Chris Green, because that's like an anomaly. Chris is nuts. He can do it and make it work, but most people, I watch them, it's like squirrel, and they're off. They're gone.
Yep.
And so, yes, I branch out. I've played around with merch by Amazon, and I made some good money at Christmas. I did my first Periscope today just to see if I had a following, and I do. And I sell on eBay and Amazon, and I always am making myself better at those. But I'm not going to chase every new invention at that moment. Now, if I can work into my life, then absolutely. But I think you've got to stay in your lane, so to speak, but always perfect it and make it better. Does that make sense?
No, that makes perfect sense. So, you know, really, I think the other thing is that you risk it becoming a job. The more you start adding these other things, that becomes pressure, right? That's more, oh, I got to do this too. Oh, I got to do this too. And it becomes that, I think, because I think the day this becomes a job, I think it's going to lose its luster for you. And you've been a pretty good example of not letting that happen. So what's next for you?
Things that I can announce. What can I announce? I got a couple fun projects in the works that are behind closed doors. I can't say anything else about that right now, but I'm actually going to Philadelphia this weekend. There's a breast cancer fundraiser that I'm attending. Nadine, my partner, is the maid of honor. Be a bad choice. I don't even know what the person of honor for this to raise money for breast cancer. But we're going to film some stuff and go outside our norm of our show and start doing some other videos. I'm speaking at three or four events, like you said, already lined up for this year. I just want to keep teaching and helping others. And I got two fun things that are in the works that if they come to fruition, I'll be the face of. And I think they'll both be A, fun and B, rewarding.
I love it. I can hear the fun in your voice. I mean, that's cool. Again, this is not a job for you. And I think that 9 years, that's living proof, 9 years. That's very helpful, I think, for a lot of people. You could see yourself doing this for 9 more?
Oh, absolutely. You know, so here's my wife and I's life plan, and it never the selling, the flipping, the treasure hunt will never end. So our life plan, and it's always been this, but I've altered it just a smidge. We always want to retire to the Florida Keys. That is our dream. And my initial thought was, let's retire on the younger side. We'll buy a bed and breakfast, so we'll have income coming in. And we'll live where we want to live. Not that we don't love living here, but I want to retire in the Keys. And then I read a couple books by people who did that. I went, no. But so I altered a smidge. And I thought, okay, my wife could work anywhere for her company around the country. And there are a few offices in South Florida. And I thought, okay, when we get closer, why don't we have the company transfer you to South Florida? They'll pay for the move. We'll get a place in South Florida and then a place in the Upper Keys. And she goes, I like that idea. Then there was one more smidge of a change. Okay, here's the deal. I want to open a tiki bar. I've always wanted to run one, but here's my thought. It's only open from 4 to 7, so happy hour. It'll make enough money just to pay for itself, and then during the day, since we'll be living in the Keys, we're going to treasure hunt around the islands and look for the flotsam and jetsam that have washed up to the, you know, because the Keys aren't the 12 you drive through. There's hundreds of them. Most of them are uninhabited. And so the cross stream from the Atlantic to the Gulf, a lot of stuff gets caught in the islands. Cool stuff, driftwood, you know, treasures, whatever. And so we're still going to treasure hunt and have it for sale at the bar and then sell it online. But it'll all be, you know, found nautical treasures. And there's big money in it.
Yeah, but it. You know, that sounds like a dream, but there's no doubt in my mind that it'll happen because that's both of your plan. I mean, I think it's just so cool. I just think, again, there's a lesson in this whole thing is that live the life you want. Stop chasing all this other kind of stuff. And I think that was your advice, you know, kind of keep staying in your lane, I think was the phrase that you used, yep. Right? Stop looking at the shiny objects. Yeah, there's lots of ways. I interviewed almost 70 successful sellers. And guess what? There have been successful private label sellers. There's been successful wholesale sellers, but successful retail or over $1 million sales. There's been successful online or sellers, right? There's successful eBay sellers. Guess what? They're all successful if that's what you want, but that's got to be what you want. Not everybody could be as successful at it and shouldn't be, you know, because it's not their thing. It doesn't work for them. So I think that's just great advice. Well, the goal of this podcast is to help people move forward, right? They get stuck, right? And I guess you've probably been there. I know I have. And so trying to help them get past that. What's the best advice, a tip or trick that you could give that we could give our listeners a chance to move their business forward?
I think the first thing is, don't be afraid of your failures. Embrace them, which, again, sounds cliche and very simplistic. But, you know, one of the things that Nadine and I do on our show, Thrifty Business, is we have a segment called the Duds of the Week. Things that we thrifted that either turned out to be a dud because we shouldn't have bought them, they sold for too little, they weighed, shipping was a lot more ridiculous than we figured, or we broke it before we got to sell it. And I, of all the stuff we do in our show, I get most feedback on that. They're like, people say to me, Jay, that's awesome. No one ever shows their mistakes. Hmm. And I'm proud of my mistakes because I tell people all the time, I learn more from what I screw up on than from what I do successful. When I do something successful, I'll remember it and repeat it. But when I do something really wrong, my dud of the week, I know for sure I'm not buying that ever again. And, oh, by the way, I'm going to tell my thousands of followers, don't ever buy this. This is not worth your time.
It's etched in your brain,
absolutely,
right? It's learning what not to buy. That's an art.
But to go along with that, and a dud could be an unhappy customer, whether it's your fault or theirs. But to go along with that is take emotion out of your business transactions. If you spend any time on Facebook or any social media, people make this buying and selling online an emotional thing, and it isn't. It's just business. That unhappy customer is really not unhappy with you because they never met you. They're just unhappy. Hmm. So all these people who then, you know, like, oh, my God, I had a customer want to return something. What do I do? And then they go to 20 Facebook groups and they whine and cry about it. People return stuff. Like, look, I bought a shirt for this event that I'm going to, this breast cancer event. Great new shirt. Hawaiian long sleeve. It was hot. It was a Tommy Bahama. I have 20 Tommy Bahamas in my closet, all the same size. They fit me beautifully. This was the same size. However, being a long sleeve, it was a tapered cut, which I did not expect. I'm a big boy, and the buttons were popping around my belly. And I just needed to return it. Now, I took a picture of myself bursting out of the shirt to show to the people who follow me, pay attention. Returns aren't emotional or personal. I bought a shirt unrealizing that some of their shirts are tapered. I didn't know any Tommy Bahama shirts were tapered. Did not know that. But here's why I offer returns, and here's why I don't care if somebody wants to return something. What am I going to do with this shirt? It don't fit me. And I'd like to lose weight. I don't plan on losing any time anytime soon. So there's no emotion to it. And luckily, the seller, I just said, can I return this? Yep. Go ahead. Easy peasy.
Yeah. Now, and you didn't have a bad reaction,
no,
right?
But you know what? I'm going to take it one step further, and I'm going to give him a little help, even though he didn't ask for it. I'm actually going to send him the picture that I'm going to post on Facebook. I'm going to show me wearing one of my normal 2XLTs and this shirt just to tell him, hey, by the way, when you relist this, make sure to write it's tapered at the waist because look how nicely the normal 2XLTs fit me and look how bad this fits me. Hmm. And so he'll be able to sell better. So instead of him maybe having another customer like myself have to return it, had it said this tapers down the waist, I would have known right away, whoops, not for Big J.
That's a great experience. So you're taking that emotion out from both sides, in essence, by helping him, right?
Yep.
Hopefully, you know, hey, you know, this is the real deal. I'm here to help you. That's really cool.
I'm not mad at him. I'm not leaving him a negative. I paid for the shipping back because, you know, it wasn't his fault. And, you know, should he have said it was tapered? Maybe he didn't realize it, you know, because most of the stuff I buy isn't stuff I wear, so I don't know. You know,
Does it say it's tapered on the label?
No, but when you put it on, it fits my chest perfectly, and then it bursts at my stomach.
Right, right. So how would he know that
right.
It's tapered? Right. I agree with you.
So I'm actually going to show that in my group. Here's a picture of the shirt that's about to choke me to death, and here's a picture in the same size that it normally fits me really, really nicely.
That's great.
So, you know, it's all about helping. I always told people, if I could help so many people that I had nothing left to thrift and no customers left to help to sell things to, I'd be fine with that. I'll go on and do something else. I'm cool with that. I don't care. I don't care that I help thousands of people. Some people get mad at me for it. I am happy to help.
I think that, again, what a great way to bring it to close because that lifestyle, you're not letting the stress get to you. It's not a job. It's something you still enjoy. I love it.
Yep.
All right. Best way to get in touch with you. I'm going to have a link for the thrifting board. We want to get that over 10,000 pretty quick, right? I can also put a link there for Thrifty Business with J&A.
Cool.
Best way to get in touch with you personally. Do you take private messages on Facebook?
Oh, yeah. All day, every day. And that's probably the quickest and easiest nowadays because that's where everybody is. And it's super easy to find me. Now, my name is Jason Smith, which there's about 10 million in the world. So don't look for that because you'll never find the right one. But if you just go to Facebook.com/TikiPug, TikiPug, pug like the little dog, Tiki like the mug, that's me. So it's super simple.
Awesome. And I'll have a link for that too. Jason, I appreciate you taking the time. You're just a regular guy who has figured it out. And I think a lot of us really want to figure it out. And I just think you're a great lesson for that. I'll be seeing you, I think, the next 4 months in a row at a conference. Honestly, I think
cool.
I'll see you in Vegas. I'll see you in Orlando. I'll see you a whole bunch of places. So can't wait to see you. I wish you nothing but continued success. I can't wait to find out what these little projects you're working on. I just can't wait to hear more. Just really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Have a good night. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did because, again, you know, sit back and think to yourself, if money wasn't an issue, you know, you still had to earn something, what would you do? And I think that's where Jason is in his life. And I just think that he's such a great example of what could be. And we're so lucky because we're in this e-commerce business where we could do what we want to meet the needs that we have at that time. And I think there's a perfect example of it. So I appreciate you listening. Check us out, ecommercemomentum.com. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the e-commerce Momentum Podcast. All the links mentioned today can be found at ecommercemomentum.com under this episode number. Please remember to subscribe and like us on iTunes.